listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Who are you anyway? Are you the you who gets impatient in traffic, or the you who is generous, giving, and forgiving? Are you the you who has specific likes and dislikes, or are you the you who is flexible and accepting of whatever comes your way? We are, of course, all of these yous at different times. Today's guest, Brian Hubbard, has a central message to share with us. Most of mankind operates from a mistaken identity. You and I are not what we think we are. We're not who we think we are. What Brian has to say about who you really are is transformative, so hang on to your hat. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we're dedicated to awakening the world to the power and importance of human emotions. You're listening to us on emotionalpro.com's radio show page or blogtalkradio.com/FPL. You can also catch us through subscription on iTunes, and we invite you to chat with us, me and our guest, Brian Hubbard, toll-free at 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. Brian Hubbard has an extensive and versatile background as a journalist, editor, publisher, and author. He is owner and managing director of two publishing companies and publisher and co-editor, along with his wife, who is best-selling author Lynn McTaggart, of the international magazine What Doctors Don't Tell You, Untrue Story of You, How to Let Go of the Past That Creates You and Become Fully Alive in the Present. You can find him at brianhubbard.net. That's brianhubbard.net. So, Brian Hubbard, welcome to Full Power Living.
Eileen, thank you so much. What a lovely introduction. And thank you very much for inviting me on your show and for your interest in the work.
Well, I definitely have interest. But let me get one thing on the table from the get-go, because I know you have a chapter on therapy. And I have been a psychotherapist for the past 43 years.
Right.
So I want to get that on the table. But okay. My work has evolved so that I help people with what I've come to understand as a universal principle. And as I was reading The Untrue Story of You, I realized that many of the ideas I work with are similar to what you express. For example, the idea that we create our own lives, or that once something from our past comes forward, it's there for us to complete and learn it so we can go on. But what happened for me when I was reading The Untrue Story is that I came to a greater understanding of how these things occur. I've just sort of taken them on faith. And what you wrote filled in a lot of blanks for me. So
okay.
A major message that you put out is that we aren't who we think we are. So would that make our biggest human task to connect with who we really are?
Absolutely. That's that's one of the principal reasons I think we're here on the planet, is to express our true nature in the world. And most of us spend most of our lives doing not that at all. And it is really, as you said, a case of mistaken identity that occurs. And, you spoke a bit earlier about therapy, Eileen, so maybe we should cross our swords a little bit at this point.
Okay.
And just talk about that for a minute, because I think, first off, I'm not a therapist. I went through a personal experience, and because of my own background and interest in areas like spirituality and in philosophy and Western philosophy, I was able to bring certain things to my own predicament, which was depression. And from that, what I believe was some major and hopefully helpful insights, not only into that problem, but the whole issue of personal identity and who we are. And and one of the things that I did mention in the book, which you've just brought up, was that of therapy. I think you know, I wouldn't want to say straight off that therapy is incredibly important and has had major breakthroughs and has helped so many people. And I accept that. But I do have an issue in one regard, which is that it's the mistake that not just therapists make, but virtually a whole of mankind makes, which is this business, again, of personal identity. And it is this, that there is, people have a problem, someone has an issue, be it anger or whatever it might be, and there is also apparently this person who can control the anger or who can change themselves. And I would dispute that, because I believe there is no difference between the anger and the supposed person who is angry. And until you see that there is no division between those two things, I would argue that true transformation is not possible. And I think that's something that, you know, is the one big difference, you know, I would make, that, you know, it isn't really talked about very much by anybody else, that somehow there is this strange person who is in control who then can affect the problems, the emotions, or whatever he has. Until you see there is no difference between the emotion or the upset or characteristic or whatever you want to call it, and the person himself, until you see there is absolutely no division at all, then true healing, I don't think, is possible.
You know, I'm really trying to understand this. You keep saying there's no division at all, and I'm not quite able to connect that.
Okay, let's go back a bit and look at, let's take anger as an issue here.
Good.
So for example, I have anger issues, right? And so, you know, my wife says, you really ought to sort this out. Go and see someone, get some help on your anger issue, because you blow up and you blow up over, you know, the slightest thing or whatever it might be. So I go and see a therapist, and what we have then is a situation where he says, I have anger issues. Okay, well, you have anger issues probably because your expectations are not being met, or you are anticipating something that might happen because it's happened to you in the past, or whatever it might be. You get irritable for these various reasons, for example. And all of this has come about because from experience. We have memories of these things happening to us. Something has happened to us in the past, and that starts to form our view of the world. Now, my argument is that memory, or essentially it's an emotional screen that is built up from the past, and we call it memory, but it's an emotional screen that through which we interpret the world. Now, this emotional screen comes about from experience, from things that have happened to us before. My argument is that there is no difference. That emotional screen is who you are. There isn't anyone separate from that who can say, now, Brian, you know, you have this emotional screen, so you have to deal with this. You have to somehow come to terms with this, overcome this. My point is that there isn't any difference, that the emotional screen creates this idea of a person who can do something about it. And whilst some progress can be made along these lines, essentially it is a dog chasing its own tail. And until you see that this emotional screen, this sense of the past, these memories are you as well, that essentially it's one and the same thing. And I think this is the one big difference I have with my own experience with depression and what some therapists would say.
Mm-hmm. So I'm beginning to get the idea that the reason this is hard for me to grasp is I think more like you. You know, I'm a recovered angry person myself, and I developed an understanding of of emotions working, and my own framework that I've used is that emotions are tools. They're tools that we use in order to navigate our lives, and that the issue is not taking anger and making it separate, but to realize that the anger is bringing me information that I can work with, and once I work with it, then I can complete it.
Sure. I mean, I think that's true. I think that It is also seeing that this sense of this I that springs up is an integral part of the anger or whatever it might be as well, and that the emotion comes first, and then the sense of ownership follows.
Yes.
And that's a really important point to get, because it's not that there isn't this I who is always a constant I who is always there, you know, who controls life, who controls his destiny and his ambitions and all the rest of it, this person in command central. There isn't that person there who, on occasion, gets angry. There is anger, which comes first. And if anyone's been really angry, you know, seeing red anger, if you can be clear enough to remember that situation, you'll see that there wasn't actually anybody there. There was pure anger. Within seconds, someone then comes into the picture, which is this sense of I. And then suddenly I become angry, or, oh my goodness, I have been angry. What have I done? I need to control that. But actually the essential anger, the pure energy of anger, comes first. Then the I comes into the picture. So the anger creates this sense of I, who then needs to control it. So if you see it that way around, any attempt to, you know, modify that anger is actually never going to succeed fully until you see that this sense of I and the anger are the same thing. And this came to me from my understanding of my own depression I had, and how we are created through the past. And let me say first off that there is something wonderful, miraculous about every single human being, which is outside of space and time, which many people would call a soul. There is certainly that element to us. But that rarely shines through, whilst the past has control of us. And there are three types of memory groups that I mentioned in the book, The Untrue Story of You. And when you suddenly see that, then there is a chance of this redemption. There is a chance then of, you know, this, you know, Eckhart Tolle talking about living in the now, and the essential thing of being able to live in the now, the power of that. But until we understand our past, it's very hard for us to actually achieve that. So, and we can talk about, it's quite interesting, because I know you've got a story to tell us as well, Eileen, about this, haven't you? Because,
I was thinking it might be a good place to put that story in.
Yeah, put that in. Yeah, tell the listeners, because it's so interesting.
So, before the show, I was talking with you, Brian, and letting you know that just reading your book, The Untrue Story of You, created a huge breakthrough for me this week. As I was contemplating unfinished past business from the past, unfinished experiences, things that I didn't fully understand or complete. The situation is that my husband, as many of you, my listeners, know, has cancer, and he's been ill for almost 4 years now. And I am not the most patient person. And when he has folded up from his normal, very competent neurosurgeon self and become a patient who can't, dial the phone with his finger, it really pushed my buttons, and I've gotten quite irritated with him and, do what you can do and so forth. And I have been searching for where was that all coming from, because I do love my husband. I don't want to be upset with him all the time when he's sick. And so Monday, when I woke up, I'd been reading your book on the weekend, and when I woke up Monday morning, I had this very clear knowing that the irritation came from a past life I've been told about. And in the past life, I was in service to a prince, and for fear of losing my own life, I agreed to lash people with a whip whenever he told me to. And I've done some work on that two or three lifetimes since. And interestingly enough, the person who was the prince is now my wonderful son, whom I love tremendously. But I became aware that in that, as I finished that lifetime, I apparently may have made a mistake, made a decision that I would never do what somebody told me to do again if I didn't want to do it myself. And that is the culprit for my husband, because I don't always want to do all the little things that he won't do for himself or feels he can't do for himself. And so it puts me, it was putting me into a conflict until I understood it.
Very interesting. And you see, the point of that is, I mean, amazing story, Arlene. But, of course, the thing is, you weren't necessarily conscious of this. So, in other words, this was happening through you from, you know, past experiences, whether it's a past life or indeed even within, you know, the current lifetime. But this past experience passes through you and, in that sense, creates you. But it's not as if you are controlling that. It's only when you have the clarity, you suddenly see the processes that are going through you, that are happening to you, that there is a chance that this ends. And I think that's, you know, that's really what happened to you, wasn't it? I think we're all in grip to the past, which creates this sense of you. And until such times you see this happening and see the movement of that, that, you know, this real radical change I'm talking about, only then can it become possible. Because, I mean, otherwise, you know, you're saying, well, look, if you've said, well, look, you know, you're a bit like this with your husband, and you should really learn to control this and be a little bit more understanding of the poor guy's ill and all the rest of it. But actually, this was passing through you. This was happening to you, and it was a past emotion or energy from the past which was passing through you. And there was no way you could actually alter that until you understood what was happening. And then that change becomes possible. And that's exactly what happened to you, wasn't it?
I can really see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what happened to me as well. But yeah.
So while we're here, this awareness came to me as I came out of my sleep. If you don't get the information that way, and I know you have a 21-day program where we can train ourselves to be more open to this, but just on a regular, everyday basis, how can you identify what's coming through you from the past?
Okay. Well, you do it by looking at the framework that I've created. It's like a map, I suppose. It's a map of thoughts and where thoughts come from and what thoughts are doing. And that's really important to become sensitive and aware of the whole process of thoughts that are going on in your head all the time. And once you start to see that and understand the map itself, then clarity starts to happen. Because fundamentally, Eileen, it comes about through a deep, profound understanding. That's how real change will occur. Now, you mentioned the 21-day program, and these are little exercises you can do every day, really to encourage the brain, or whatever you want to call it, to start, you know, being able to become aware of its own thinking processes. But ultimately, it's what happened to you. It's that sudden understanding that occurred. I mean, for you, that was a real reach to go through a previous life. I mean, if we just try and deal with the ones in our own life, then, which is a lot easier, then, of course, it's the clarity of that. And then once it's clear, it's like turning the light on. You know, that characteristic, that behavior pattern just drops away. And that's actually what does happen.
My father, in this lifetime, was a military man who forced me to do what he told me to do. He would beat me or slap me. And I have looked there to the past, but that didn't unhook me.
That didn't do it, no. Okay. Well, it came
No.
from somewhere deeper and further away. And I think, you know, the
Yeah.
other thing is the also the patterns of family groups and generational groups as well. I mean, it's so fascinating. It really is incredible. And I mean, there's been a lot of studies into that and how people from even, you know, 150 years ago affect how you are. And it sounds weird, but there's been a lot of science into this, and they said it actually is true. And so, you know, we are, you know, we're open to all these influences of the past, whether it's from our own lives, whether it's a previous life, whether it's a generational thing. I mean, it just does go on and on. So the only thing we can be is utterly clear, to become very, very sensitive and aware of our thinking and where does our thoughts come from and what are they trying to do. And as I say, what the book tries to provide people is with a map, a terrain to help them see that and to locate those thoughts.
So let's talk a little bit about, actually, we're up close to a break here, so let's take a break first,
Okay.
and then when we come back, can we go into the framework a little bit more and have you explain
Absolutely, we
that to
can.
us? All right, great.
Sure, Eileen. Sure.
My guest today is Brian Hubbard, who's author of The Untrue Story of You. He wants us all to see ourselves and our world as it really is, and you can find out more when we return here on Full Power Living. Know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us. Four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives, as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free emotional mastery teleseminar. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Please sign up now at emotionalpro.com to be on our mailing list. We'd like to send you our biweekly newsletter telling you about our programs. Next week, we have another amazing program for you that comes right off of this one as I talk with Julia Shopik about her Amazon.com best-selling book, Honest Medicine, Effective, Time-Tested, Inexpensive Treatments for Life-Threatening Diseases. We're exploring, too, whether you should listen to your own gut when the advice of your doctor that your doctor gives you isn't working. And I'm aware that my guest today, Brian Hubbard, right, has a newsletter about this very topic, so that should be interesting, too. So next week it's 9 a.m. Pacific time, Thursday, September 17th. That's noon Eastern time. And thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. When you're on the Emotional Pro homepage, be sure to get your copy of my free list of the signals of seven everyday emotions. They will help you to immediately move toward mastery over the emotions that come up in your life. And today's conversation will also. Today, I am talking with editor, publisher, and author Brian Hubbard about his book, The Untrue Story of You, which was published by Hay House. John Gray, author of Men Are from Mars and Women Are from Venus, says, Brian, in his book, quote, offers one of the most significant advances in our understanding of who we are, why we do what we do, and how we can end the negative patterns that hold us back. So that's a really nice endorsement, Brian. And listening to that ad that we put on, I'm thinking I may have to evolve that program a little bit, having been exposed to you and your ideas. But before the break, we were talking about the framework that you offer, the three energy centers, if you will.
Okay. Well, should I sort of start your advert just then, Eileen, was, you know, about children and the emotional basis that we carry on through our lives, which we develop, you know, within the first few years of life, which is absolutely right. And maybe we could start there, really, because this is what we carry through with us, isn't it? And that not just, you know, that becomes, as I say, like the emotional filter through which we see the world, you know, going forward. However we respond to it, or indeed how we expect it to be, is determined by those early years. So, you know, let's maybe start there, because, as I say, my own voyage of discovery really came about through depression, and after I'd had quite an abusive childhood myself. And I mentioned in my book how for the first 7 years my own father never called me by my name, but just whistled for me, and until my mother said, you know, this really does have to stop. But you know, quite extraordinary business, really. And but just talking generally for a minute, I mean, what we are is what's our natural state? You know, let's deal with that for a moment. And it is pure consciousness. It is being. It's the purity of seeing and of listening and of being. And our natural resting place, as I call it, is actually a few feet outside of us. We're always looking out into the world, and that's where our focus naturally is. And it is really from the start of life, when we're babies. And, you know, we've seen evolutionists and biologists say that, you know, the extent of a baby's vision is from where it's lying to the mother's breast, you know. So even from that point on, the outward move of being outside, and where our attention rests naturally, is outside, a few feet outside us all the time. And what happens is that when the baby, let's stay with the baby for a minute, when the baby suffers some pain or discomfort, as babies do, that focus shifts. And it shifts from that point 3 feet outside of itself to the body itself. And it shifts to the body until that discomfort or pain goes away. And then the shift goes back outside of itself. But increasingly, as we suffer trauma or shouted at or whatever happens, our focus moves back in on ourselves. And as that happens, we start to build a sense of a self that is this body. This body then becomes the point of reference for every experience that we've there, you know, hitherto have. And this is what happens to us all, that we have this focus shifting back to ourselves, and we experience everything from our own point of view. Now, that's not wrong, and it is true, but it's not the truth, because once we have a body-centered experience where my point of reference is always my body, myself, I am not seeing the totality of the experience any longer. I may be shouted at, and that is true, but what I'm not understanding is why someone has shouted at me, or the background to that, or what have you. Now, you might say, well, that would take an enormous effort for someone to understand all of that, which probably is the case. But nonetheless, because we don't have that total elevated view of an experience, it becomes a memory. It's something that we hold in us as an emotion, being shouted at, what traumatized or what have you. And that's certainly what happened to me. And I carried that energy around with me for a very long time. Now, what happens is, when we have an experience that we haven't fully understood because it is body-centered, it will form an energy, it will form an emotion, it will form a memory, and it will form it in one of three ways. There are three memory types we have. One is called psychological. Another is narrative, which is the memory of our own story. And the third is memory of knowledge memory, how we do things. Now, you may say, well, I'm just making this up, but actually there was a study done after I published this book, which actually found just that. There were the three memory types, which was psychological, which was knowledge, and which was narrative. And it actually is quite interesting. You actually see that in dementia and Alzheimer's patients, that they will, for example, remember something from their childhood, a narrative memory thing, but don't remember how to do something, or one of the other memories comes into play. So these three memory groups actually form this sense, ultimately, of who we are. And that's what we are. We are this past, which is expressed in the world through one or several of these memory groups at the same time. So what often happens is that several memory groups will fuse. So, for example, you have a narrative memory, so which is, you know, and it's all a memory. When I say to you, what's your name, and you say, Eileen, well, your name's not really Eileen, is it? But it's a memory that someone has called you that, and you know that. And that comes to mind. Then if I say, Eileen, where did you go to school? Well, you have to dig a bit deeper there. You have to think about that one for a few seconds more, but then you'll come up with the answer. What religion were you brought up in? Whatever it was, you can come up with it. And slowly you build the story of who you are. But of course, you're not really that thing. Because if I said your natural state is this sense of awareness of being, which is pure, there is nothing, you aren't really Eileen, are you? That's a memory we have. And that forms our narrative memory, the story of who we are, right? And we need it. It's a necessary memory to have, because otherwise we'd never get anywhere in life. It's a shorthand, isn't it? Eileen, you put your hand up, we know who you are. We need that. It's a necessary thing. But we have other memories, and we also need knowledge. We need to know how to drive our car when we get into it. We know how to fix a light bulb when it blows. We need to know those things. But sitting above that are the psychological memories. These are the memories we have, which is the emotional filter of trauma, of bad experience, and all the rest of it. Now, when you fuse, for example, a narrative memory with a psychological memory, that is the home of war. This is why we have, you know, problems in the world, whether it's terrorism or war. It is a narrative of a people coupled with a psychological memory of injustice, of wrongs done to them, or whatever it might be. And that's expressed out in the world as a war. And this is what happens to us. And so this goes on and on. But all of these things are the past. It's all the past. And the longer we live and the more experience we have, which is body-centered, because it's a bit like, you know, I don't know if they're doing these, there used to be this sticky paper which flies used to stick to. I used to have them in England. I don't know if you had them in the States years ago. You had a little fly trap, which was a sticky piece of paper. Well, that's essentially what we become, you know. We are like this sticky fly paper, and it builds us. We have more and more body-centered experiences. We become more a sense of this substantial self, right? And this substantial self has more and more memories and significance in the world. But it's not true. I mean, it's like smoke, actually, but it has enormous bearing on our lives. It has enormous consequences in the world. But it's all memory groups. They're memory forms. That's all they are. But they cause so much problem in the world, and it drives you. But when you look at it, there's nothing there. It's all from the past, you know? And until we really understand that, and that's driving you, that is what is driving this sense of you. You know, what we said at the very beginning, you said, well, how does that work out? Well, it's because these memory groups are actually create this sense of a substantial self, which has all these reactions in the world. You know, you hurt me, you upset me, you disappointed me. I want to be rich, I want to be famous, I want this, I want that. I want to be enlightened, I want to be happy. But actually, you are already happy. It's just that you think you're not. And these thoughts come from memories, from these experiences. The one thing that stops you from being happy is the thought that you're unhappy. And when you understand that, and you understand where that thought comes from, then the clarity of that can change that whole movement. And that's essentially what I discovered through my own depression, because I wanted to understand, well, who actually is depressed, you know? Because it didn't really make much sense what had happened to me. And this is really what I uncovered. And, you know, I just think it's just a useful insight for others to have.
So can I ask you a question? You might be able to help me
sure.
with this then.
Sure.
My husband's scheduled for an MRI next week,
mm-hmm.
and he's never had
mm-hmm.
one. And he's following a pattern that he follows with almost everything that
mm.
is new or is a thing to be done.
Mm.
And that is
mm.
he started getting scared maybe 10 days
mm.
out and has
mm.
a lot of stuff to process and so forth.
Mm.
Now, yesterday, when he started telling me, I'm scared and I want to talk with you, I talk about not having
mm.
patience. I just said,
yeah.
I don't understand why you need to do this to yourself. I really don't. You know,
mm.
you're going to go there. You're going to either do it or not do it. You know, if you get
mm.
claustrophobic, then they'll
mm.
just stop and so forth.
Mm.
And I suggested to him that he just, you know, refuse to listen to all of that and listen to
mm.
something else instead. And yesterday,
mm.
for the first time ever, he did, and he had a really good day.
Right.
What?
Right.
How using your system would you work
mm.
with something like that?
Well, the first thing is that, you know, we do this all the time, don't we? We project from the past into the future, so we imagine what something will be. And
right.
that is fear. That's fear. And that is
right.
because something like that has happened before. That we, and it's an imaginary future, isn't it? We imagine what it's
yes.
going to be like in the dentist chair. We imagine what it's going to be like in the doctor's surgery or what have you. But we can't know because we're not actually in the situation at that moment. So it's obviously in imagination. So we have to see, well, what is that movement that has projected a future for me? And it comes from the past. And all thought is very interesting. When you look at thought, and this is what I'm talking about, when you start looking carefully at thought, you'll see it's always a projection from the past to an imagined future. And it's a movement that creates time. But it's obviously it is imagined. So what he has to do is to, well, there are several things, you know, but actually one of the, you talk about that 21-day exercise, one of the exercises actually does deal with that because it deals with there are only facts in the world and there are only two things you can do with a fact. You know, you can do something about it or you can't do something about it. I mean, I know this sounds terribly simple, but it actually is true. And, you know, whatever the situation is, whether it's going to an MRI scan or getting into debt or whatever, you know, that you can either do something about it or you can't do something about it. And you can almost, it's always worth writing it down on a piece of paper, you know, so you have whatever the issue is in your life, or you can do it for a number of issues and do two little columns on the right-hand side and, you know, or so these are action and inaction. And then you have to be very specific and then look at, in terms of action, well, what can you do? Well, for example, if it is going for, you know, a doctor's appointment, well, you can cancel it. You don't have to go. If you don't want to go, you don't have to go. And you can say, well, okay, you have to rationalize that and say, well, if I don't go, what are the implications of that? Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on the situation. Only you can answer that. But if you ultimately say, well, there's nothing I can do, I have to go, that if you can see that very clearly, that could become the ending of the worry of it. Because if you've got to the point of seeing that there actually is nothing you can do with that situation, and be very, very clear about that, then the process of time, which by which I mean the past to the future, actually stops. Because you've actually consciously looked at this in a rational way and said, you know, there really is nothing I can do. You know, alternatively, as I say, but oftentimes there are things you can do, depending on what the situation is. You know, there are often many things you could do, but most times we neither do nor not do anything about it. What we do instead is worry about it. And
yeah.
that's how most of us go. It just goes round and round and round, as we know. you know, whether it's we got money worries or something like that, we'll go round and round. But we won't either act or not act. We'll worry. And this is the movement of the past to the future, which is what, you know, worry is, which is the whole thing, which is what's happening with your own husband. And really, when you become that conscious of that movement and actually carry through a simple exercise like that, great stillness can come, you know, and then the fear goes away, you know, because you've dealt with it. You've done what you can do, and that gives clarity, and it just, as I say, it does dispel the fear, and it may be worthwhile, you know, your husband doing that.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'll pass that on. I generally am in the middle of doing these things with him, and I'm aware that that's either there's something you can do or you can't do is exactly what I did. I said, well,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
if you get into the MRI and you get claustrophobic, then you can.
Is that
stop.
His concern? Is the claustrophobia? Is it that worries him?
Well, you know, I think more than anything, it's not the claustrophobia itself, but the loss of face if he can't do the procedures that he himself has ordered but has never experienced.
He's imagining himself in that situation, isn't he?
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
I know. And it's so silly because we do it all the time. And I don't mean to denigrate that by saying it's silly, but it is silly because, you know, we imagine ourselves projecting ourselves into this future situation, which we can't possibly know, and create all these problems that way. I mean, when people are frightened of going to the dentist, I say, well, how incredibly, you know, what amazing foresight you have and prescience to be frightened of going to the dentist, because I've got no idea what's going to happen to me at the dentist, but you know. Isn't that marvelous how clever you are? I wish I could have your foresight.
No, you don't. That's very funny.
Not really, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, but you know, that becomes really abundantly clear in reading the untrue story of you, how much of what we have experienced in the past we just put through ourselves. And I'm aware, as you're talking, that when we're busy doing that, there is no room to be present in our lives.
No,
it's almost
not present. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's almost like we're doing it in order to keep ourselves from being present.
Yeah. Well, when you're present, you can't actually think. It's quite interesting. You have to step out of the present moment to think. Well, even if it's, you know, there are obviously the thought we have, you know, the most useful thoughts we have are problem-solving thoughts, you know. How do I fix this problem? How do I do this? But even when you're doing that, you actually step out of that present moment in order to have that thought, and you become less aware of that present moment in order to think. And you know, and that's good thinking. That's you know, healthy thinking. But most of the time, you know, our thinking is either pointless, useless, you know, chattering to ourselves, and you know, it all it does is regurgitating past into future. Is essentially what thinking is. It's past to future all the time. You can't think from past to now. You think even if the future is 5 minutes ahead of now, it's still ahead. And that's fascinating. Now I've told you that, you know, maybe some listeners could actually play around with that and see if that actually is right. Because, you know, it's tools to use in your life. It's not a case of saying, oh, Brian's right, so therefore. It's a case of saying, finding out for yourself, discovering this, seeing if what I'm saying is true. And, you know, I think it's quite a fascinating thing to do. And when you see, but when this movement occurs from past to future, what actually happens is we create this sense of a substantial self. But it's utterly illusory. It's nothing there. It's just smoke and mirrors, you know? But this substantial self then gets hurt, then gets angry, then demands this, then demands that, then, you know, whatever it might be. But, you know, we're not that at all. We're this beautiful, natural state of, you know, of consciousness itself. That's essentially what we are. And, you know, we've lost that. That's gone because of the overarching power of the past to live our lives, you know, through us. And this is why patterns occur as well. A Are we okay for a break? Are you okay for a minute? Yeah. This is why patterns occur, because what's happening is it's a working out of the past into the world. You know, and the one thing I will say about all this is that everything is seeking resolution. I really firmly believe that. I believe that none of this is bad or nasty. I believe it's there to be understood. And I believe everything in life is a move towards a resolution. And I think that's true of our past, of our incomplete experiences, of our incomplete understandings. And we will play that out again. We'll play it out again. We'll have the same issues again. We'll make the same mistakes again, or similar mistakes, because it's trying to be understood. And it's that energy, because it is an energy. It's the energy of the past.
Right.
Playing out in the present moment to be understood. And when you finally get it, the pattern stops.
Huh. Well, I'd like to tell you a story from my life that actually illustrates that some. When I was around 12, my father molested me sexually. It brought all kinds of fear and anger forward in me and dominated my life for the next 30 years. And that's where a lot of the anger that I experienced came from. So I did some learning, and eventually I realized that I needed to complete my feelings with my father so I wouldn't stay angry with him forever. As I learned more about anger, I realized the anger was hurting me more than it was hurting him.
Sure. Of course. Absolutely,
And you make this point in your book, The Untrue Story of You, which I've never seen anybody make before, and I really appreciated it, which is that what motivated me was I finally one day realized that as long as I stayed angry with him, he was actually getting me twice.
Right.
Once at the time of the perpetration, and then for all the damage that holding that anger inside of me was doing.
Right.
So I decided that I needed to forgive him. And I was motivated by people had been telling me that there were such things as past lives, and I thought, gosh, this life has been so difficult. I sure as heck don't want to do this again. I want to get finished, you know. So my father had cancer, and I didn't see him personally, but I talked to him on the phone one day, and by that point, I knew that I wanted to forgive him. And so I asked him if he would accept my forgiveness, and he said yes. And I asked him to forgive me for my reactions to him, the things that I had said or done, and he agreed to do that. And then I was able to thank him for being my father in this lifetime. And that finished all that past for me.
When
I went to his funeral, my sister called on me and said, "Why aren't you crying?" And I said, I'm finished. There's nothing left.
Well, that's a wonderful story, Arnie, and a wonderful example. And you know, my heart goes out to you for what happened. But yeah, and the essential point of forgiveness, of course, is as you rightly say. And sometimes we can't have that resolution in our lives because the person has passed on or whatever. But you know, the essential point of forgiveness is forgiving yourself for carrying that load. You know, and that's really, because a lot of people say, "Well, forgiveness." New Age people keep talking about forgiveness. Well, Jesus spoke about it as well. But anyway, but that aside, people say, "Well, how can you forgive someone who's done such terrible things to you?" Well, you forgive yourself for carrying that load, and that's really what you do. And in that, and because that's part of the forgiveness, and that's the most important part, that we must forgive ourselves for carrying the cross all that time, you know. And that's, you know, and that's something we can understand, that's something we can do, because that was important for you, wasn't it, Eileen, that you forgave him, but you forgave yourself. And if he hadn't been alive, you'd have to forgive yourself. He couldn't do that for you.
I hadn't completed that experience, that's what would have stayed with me and literally weighed me down.
Absolutely, that would have stayed with you. And that would have been, you know, the continuing emotional filter through which you see the world. You know, and you're done with that. You're doing a lot of work here,
right,
Arlene. I mean, you're with your husband, and now you tell me about your father. I mean, a lot of work going on here. But it's essential stuff. But we become sane. which means we become present, you know, when we go through that. You know, it's
yes.
so essential
yes.
that we do. Yeah, because then you begin
yes.
The true Eileen, which is not really Eileen, but the true you, really shines through as a result. You know, not the traumatized girl or the whiplash lady from a previous life, but just this wonderful essence of you just shines through in the world, and that's really where we want to be. It's bliss. It's true happiness. You know, it's beyond happiness in a way. It's something very wonderful. Yeah.
Yes, and you know, my son and I have talked together, and I got some insight about this in reading your book also. A lot of things happen, like with my husband ill, a lot of people go, gosh, this must be so hard for you. Well, it is and it isn't, you know, because it's his process, and I help him, but I'm so much of an observer that I end up being neutral a lot of the time. And you
yeah.
talk about that in your book. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, with ourselves or with other people, you mean?
I experience it with both. I end up going,
yeah.
you know, things
well,
like,
I think,
well, that's an interesting
but,
thing
but
I just
is,
did.
But, you know, when I said a moment ago how true our true nature is that of pure observing, of pure hearing, of pure seeing, you know, that's our essential
uh-huh.
nature. Well, that's what we can use as well, because if that's what we essentially is something that we are, then we can. That's the tool we actually have. We can use that to see ourselves objectively. You know, we're not tied up in the drama and emotion of ourselves if we can be that purity. And that's the great, that's the get out, you know, for all of us, that we can be that thing. And in a sense, looking, you know, even when you, in your case, Arlene, with being traumatized in the way that you were, to even be able to see that in a dispassionate and objective way. And that is, you know, that's the great hope. And we have to, because if you don't, going back to the point I made right at the beginning of the show, there is no difference between the anger and the person who is angry. But when
right.
you see that, and you see that, you see that now, then you've created distance, because the distance is the observer itself looking at the anger, as opposed to this me that gets angry, but is actually a creation of the anger. That me who is a creation created by the anger can do nothing about the anger, because it's one and the same thing. But when you see that whole process, and you can actually be the pure observing of that objectively, then that is the place where true healing can occur. But not down at the ground level, you know, where the idea of, you know, there's me who gets angry and I have to do something about it. This is where, you know, I know this is the grist and the mill of a lot of therapy, and it does good, as I say, but ultimately it can't resolve it, because it's one and the same thing, and you have to step beyond that. And, you know, and I think your husband also has to go do that. He has to step outside of the processes that are going on in his body now and step into
mm-hmm.
the place where he really is, which is this great awareness, which never changes. Never changes. I mean, the Buddha said, you know, when I look at the mirror, the thing that sees through my eyes is the same as when I was 5, and now I am 70. And yet that is true. The pure essence of seeing doesn't age. It doesn't change, because it's outside of space and time. It's something quite remarkable about us. And that's, if we can sit in that place, then even when our bodies are a cancer, as your poor husband has, or in your case where you're traumatized as a child, we can step outside of that. We aren't essentially that thing. And when we can see that, see the process that are going on almost beneath us, you know, as if we're in a plane looking down at the ground, you know, then that chance of healing occurs, you know, and that's so essential. And it has to be like that. If you're on the ground and you have identified with the issues, the emotion, the energy of all that, ultimately you can't resolve it there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Hmm. So that's why you
well,
know, yeah.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt,
no.
but we've come to
not
the end
all.
Of our show.
Yeah, you didn't have a second break, Eileen.
No, I made it an executive decision. That's a nice thing. It's not being my show.
You can do things like
that.
I hope
you didn't need that, yeah. Frank.
No, I didn't. Your listeners might, but I didn't.
We were having such a good talk. Sometimes I don't like to interrupt.
I love talking to you, and your stories are remarkable, Eileen, and you're doing such fantastic work yourself, so well done.
Great. Well, we're going to be talking a little bit. Thank you very much. We're going to be talking a little bit about your area with your magazine and what doctors don't tell you, but perhaps in another show you'd come back and talk with us about what you do in that magazine.
We'd love to do that. It's equally as fascinating, and we're about to launch the magazine in the States. So there's a lot to tell your listeners about that, and we can tell you all about our stories and about how we've had all sorts of people trying to get us banned in the UK and all the great things we've done for thousands of people. So I'd be very happy to be, and maybe have Lynn on the show as well, because she's my wife and fellow editor, and she's got a tale or two to tell as well. So we'd be delighted to be back sometime, Eileen.
All right. I will contact you about that. So I just want to say, for me, I found your work brilliant, and I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to help you get the word of your book, The Untrue Story of You, out to the public. And I think there are people who are ready to utilize your message for their own good, and may this message go out to every one of those. So,
thank you. Thank you so much for helping me do that.
Yes, well, I want to let you know how grateful I am for taking the twists and turns of your own early life experiences and putting them into a narrative that can help all of us. So thank you for writing The Untrue Story of You, and thank you for taking your time to be here with us on Full Power Living today.
Thank you, Eileen. It's been a great pleasure.
Great. All right, so join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern Time, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. And remember that next week we're talking about Honest Medicine with Julia Shopik, and that's September 17th at 9 a.m. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer today. Thank you, Paul. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.